I hadn't.
Can you tell me what year it was you first met my father, Anthony Diamond?
I simply don't remember when I first knew Tony Diamond. I think I met him down in Juneau once upon a time over legislative work. I was much interested at that time in the legislation of the state and what was happening. And he was running, you see, for the representative for the Congress.
Well, was this after he served in the territorial legislature and was running for the United States Congress?
This was before.
This was before that, perhaps in the 1920s? I see.
In the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
When I knew him best was that year at Kennicott.
Yeah.
He was the lawyer for the Kennicott Guggenheim people, and he came up to the Kennicott mine about once a month and had talks with their management and everything. And I got there a little bit late for the year's teaching. All the tables were made up, and I sat at the head of the head table where visitors sat, and where when Mr. Meeting was there, he always sat. He had stayed over. His wife wasn't there sometimes, and he ate down at the meeting.
Was this the manager you're talking about?
Mr. Needing, the manager.
Manager,
at the mine.
Yes.
Manager at the mine. And your father would always be at the visitor's table. And the girls, the other girls, some of the nurses, used to worry if I didn't like to, didn't it worry me to have all those men around? And they were such interesting men. And I came up there one time setting up insurance work, you see, and I saw the way. The way they had to work to get their insurance ideas worked out, and that's where a good lawyer had a lot of business.
And that was my father.
And your father was the lawyer that was helping to the insurance people to try to get more than they thought they had coming.
Do you remember any particular incidents?
Not he was always quick on the uptake. Needing was a quick man. You didn't say anything if you didn't expect somebody to pick it up and toss it back to somebody else. And if you weren't careful, pretty soon you'd toss something where you just weren't sure where you were landing. it kept us all on our toes. It was more of a fun meeting. Every day we'd go down there and something would have happened somewhere in the office or the school or somewhere. Somebody would have to tell.
Yeah.
We'd have these little jokes. And it was one of the most pleasant experiences of talking with someone who was interested in doing things. And then, as I say, your father went back to Washington, D.C., you know, as representative. And after he got back to Washington, and that's where I saw the man change, and my mind is concerned, he saw what Alaska was, how big it was, how great it was. When he got back, he was a Western boy. A New Yorker, I know, but really he had been raised in the West a good deal. And when he saw what they were doing to us up here, what they could do to us.
The big corporations, you mean.
The big
yes.
companies.
Yeah.
The big things. We couldn't build our own. We couldn't. He became the most ardent Alaskans I ever knew.
Yeah.
He completely, shall I say, he was converted. That might be a good term to use for Catholic.
When you were there at Kennicott, do you remember any particular anecdote? You said my dad had a quick mind and
I don't. Things would happen if somebody say something, you know, and somebody else would answer, and the first thing you know, you were off on some angle that you just didn't quite understand, and it was always full of interest.
Yes. What years were those?
We were 24, 25.
24 and 25, you were teaching at the
Kennicott. I was teaching at Kennicott camp there.
I see. How many people lived there at that time?
We only had the two teachers and 13 pupils. And Kennicott shortaged one of them, and the company furnished the other one, so they'd be sure to have teachers for their people that were there.
13 students. What grades did you have?
We had everything.
From first through?
First on through.
Through eighth grade or
yes.
any high school students?
Well, we had one girl, the Needing girl, was taking some high school work.
Correspondence?
She was doing it mostly with her father at home, who was a very ardent Latin student.
Is that so?
She was doing most of that at home. But they had spent most of their winter, the kneading girls, down with their grandfather in Juneau, Shepherds, the old family of Shepherds down there. You will find their family close to connected, I think, with some of your father's records, too, the Shepherd family.
Yes. Do you recall any particular incidents after my father returned to Anchorage and became judge? Any particular thoughts about him? Or
no, not particular about that. We were always... He and I got mixed up one time in signing a petition. I don't know.
You remember what the petition was for?
Yes. Did you ever hear that story?
I don't believe I did.
Well, I was called into the back room one day at the courthouse. Mrs. Brewington called me back. She showed me a paper, said, "Did you sign this?" Your father was judge then. I was just sitting in some court case I wanted to hear. And I said, "Let's see what it was." And I looked there. I never wrote that. It was a petition to have a renewal of the last chance.
Liquor license. Oh.
And I looked down, and there was your father's name just below mine.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
We were both signing up to get a renewal for the... Well, we found out after we'd hunted around a little while that the boys had been hired to get names for a petition. And they took a telephone book, and every so often they marked a name. And it just happened that we had hit the same name. We were right on the same page, your father and I signing up for... And at that time, it
created quite a furor, I suppose.
It was notorious as it is yet. I mustn't say that out loud. We're getting to be quite the thing now, this idle hour business and all that.
Yeah.
Jimmy Sumter, you see.
Yeah.
And your father took it all very good-natured, and so it was kind of a joke on us. But I remember when Judge McCary heard about it, he felt that something should have been done to call attention to the fact that that was the way they were getting.
Yes, but nothing was.
No, but your father took it so good-naturedly, and that was because he saw a bigger outlook at things than just one little saloon.
Yeah.
One little drinking place. The rest was big and had to be all come in for Alaska. He began to think of Alaska as something. A tangible, something big and important.
Yeah.
It's too bad he couldn't have lived long enough to have...
To have seen statehood.
Yeah. And put his mind to work on helping us with statehood. I've always been so sorry that his mind wasn't one of the minds being used in getting statehood. We aren't straightening out on it too straight yet.
Yes.
We need too much... good thinking we are not getting.
Yes, it would be wonderful if he could have at least been here to advise people.
I wish he could have seen. I wish he'd had a little more time to have gone into this borough business. He could see how it was, I know.
Yes. Of course, many people back in the 30s and 40s couldn't understand why Alaska should become a state, but he had the vision to see into the future.
He saw Alaska as something big.
Yes, and he felt that millions of people
would live
here.
He saw it particularly after he got back to Washington and saw what this money could do to us if they got hold of us.
Yes, that's right.
And now people tell me I'm wrong on that. That he was always completely a Guggenheim man, a corporation lawyer, and that sort of thing. He was until he saw the need. And that's the big thing in your father's life to me, that he could see the need for Alaska.
Yes. Now.
And made the change.
Yeah.
That's my tribute to Tony Diamond, that he saw the need that we had up here. Mm-hmm. I was a Hills Brother. We all drank Hills Brother. Of course we drank Hills Brother. Us and the natives drank Hills Brother's coffee and Yellow Hip Lipton's tea. and we knew what was good, and that was the end of it. But we happened to be in the old Anchorage grocery one day, and this man was there just supposing fresh coffee and all, some new kind of. I said, no, I wouldn't even bother to taste that. It wasn't Hill's Brothers. And your father stood there and teased me about it. He said, I wouldn't change. It was being an old-timer, I wouldn't change my mind. We old-timers had ideas and so forth. And this traveling man, well, we dickered back and forth quite a while about how we were along. And I can remember your father was so amused that I said, no, you're just like the rest of the old-timers. You won't change an idea when you once get it. And I said, I'm not unless we're big enough to see the need for the change as you saw it once in your life. And
what did he say to that?
He looked at me. He made no answer. And this traveling man didn't know what we were talking about.
You think my dad understood what you were talking
about?
Oh,
we got through on that with nobody's business.
Good. I just wondered if you'd ever said that to him.
Well, because I didn't take the attitude that he did about having those names. I wasn't particularly flattered to have my name on it. But I can see now that he was much bigger. It didn't bother him. He had so many other things that were so
bigger things on his
and
mind.
And me, I was just living in Anchorage.
Yes, that's.
Do you see?
I get the point.
Well, that's the point of view that I try to get through with Judge Diamond.
Yeah.
He was Alaska. More nearly, and most of the people that are trying to think they're Alaska now.
That's right, because they can't see beyond their own patch of ground.
Yes.
Whereas my father could see the future of the whole state.
I think he had one of the biggest outlooks for the future for us, if it could have worked out. Now, one never knows why things have to be. It seems to be needed.
Yes, perhaps it's not a good comparison, but I think of Winston Churchill being sent to the English people when they needed him the most, and I think perhaps Anthony Diamond was sent to Alaska needed him the most.
Yes, if we could have... But so many people still held to the old idea that he was a corporation lawyer, and
after he served in Congress,
but he's a Guggenheim man, and of course most of us, not many of us, but many of us knew that the Guggenheims were not here to help Alaska.
Actually, their name is not well known up here anymore.
Well, no, they lost out.
Yes.
They found cheaper labor, they found cheaper everything somewhere else, and the copper up there was too expensive to get out, and they didn't handle labor well.
Where was their headquarters? What was the name of the place?
Guggenheim.
The copper mining place,
Kennicott. Kennicott was the center here.
They had the town named Kennicott.
And then there was... the Cordova, you see, was the railroad head. That was the shipping point.
I see, and they shipped on the railroad from Cordova to Kennicott.
To Kennicott.
Now, what was the importance of Chittenah in those days? What was its purpose?
Well, they didn't.
Purpose?
They didn't have money to build the big bridges it would take to. So the Chittenah, and they let the Chittenah River go out every year. At the ice, take it out and put a new bridge in. They pulled back the flooring every year and built a new bridge because it was cheaper to build a new bridge than it was to the work on making the other one over.
I see. Was Chittenah connected with Kennicott by road?
No, just railroad.
It was one of these stations.
By railroad.
Between Cordova and
they had
Kennicott.
A roadhouse there, and you stayed all night on the way up to... Up to Kennicott.
I see. It was a stopping point on the way to Kennicott.
It was a stopping point to Kennicott. You got on the train in Kennicott, in Cordova, and stayed all night at Chittenah.
Yes.
And,
okay.
The first year I went to Tamanaw was the year they had put up the first tower.
Radio
tower. Mm-hmm. At Tamanaw.
What year was that?
That was 1910.
Yes.
And after all, the first thing you'd see is you got into Tylenol.
Yes, but, may I interrupt here and say this is Ora D. Clark speaking. I don't think I've mentioned it before. A retired school teacher who has lived in Alaska for how many years?
Oh, too long.
50 years? Or close to it?
I came in 1906 first.
Well, that's the year my dad came, so mm-hmm. we were
so,
same time.
Well, and that was the beginning already to look at those beautiful dogs they had to keep the trail open.
They used to keep the trail open for the telephone
lines. For the telegrams.
And then
telegraph lines.
And the telegraph lines. And then when the radio came to Alaska,
they didn't need it
to keep these wires open.
We didn't take the army away for protection from Indians or anybody else. They took it away because they didn't need it anymore.
For communication.
Communication. Wireless was here. As I say, that little Italian knew too much.
Marconi.
Were you
teaching at Tylenol?
I was at Tylenol that year.
1910-12,
I taught at Tylenol.
Did you have both Bureau
of Indian Affairs.
Did you have all Native
I was with the
students?
Bureau of Indian Affairs. I had no white children there at all at Tylenol.
I
was out at the village.
Mm-hmm.
At the Tylenol village.
Did the children know any English before came to school? They did.
They'd had the army there.
The
army had been in there and built the fort, and there was a battalion of soldiers there. I don't think Governor Greening has covered the army period well at all in his book,
The State of Alaska.
And I've been trying to get hold of him to talk to him, but every time I have a fight over something else, and then we can't get to talk about that.
Does he come to see you when
he's... Well, once in a while we have a talk.
Yeah.
But he's so firmly convinced that he should tear up the Rampart Dam and cover all that country up there.
How do you feel about Rampart? You're opposed to it?
Can't see it. I don't know how you feel.
I haven't studied it thoroughly.
I don't know how your father would have felt.
I don't know either.
I have a feeling that he would see the possibilities that we had there rather than just one thing, a big dam with a name to it.
Yes, well, of course, the people who are in favor of Rampart claim to be looking to the future also.
They're looking to the future, but in what way?
I think it's providing power for Canada and the northern United States. Isn't that the idea?
That's part of the idea, but is that all of the idea?
Well, can you think of something else that might be in the backs of their minds?
Well, I don't know. That's what I wish you knew.
Well, I suppose one could make a study of it and get all the reports and talk to people who know about it.
That's one of the good places for you to begin.
Well, I want to go back in history a few more years and start from there. I'd like to start with 1906, since that's the year that my dad came to Alaska, and that's the year you came to Alaska.
Yeah.
Did you ever go to Valdez in those early days?
I never lived in Valdez. I came through Valdez when I came into the country in 1906.
You landed there?
We came through there.
Your steamship landed there.
That was the only way of getting in was boats, you see. Came in on the old Iliamna. We had Portland had a wreck, and we were crowded in the old Iliamna. I met Judge Bunnell then. He was in charge of the schools in Valdez at that time. He had come into the country as a Bureau of Indian Affairs teacher, you know.
Yes, and he later became the first president, of the University of Alaska?
University of Alaska.
And was president for many years.
Yes. In fact, he's still, I suppose he died still thinking he made it.
I remember Judge Bunnell.
Yes.
And also his daughter, Jean.
Yes. And what became of Jean?
I haven't heard either.
I haven't heard from Jean since her father's death. Yes. She took care of him during his last days, I believe. Came up and helped make him home. Because he bungled life pretty thoroughly.
I see. I don't know too much about his background.
That's the trouble. Too much of the background is sometimes not too pleasant.
Yes, well, maybe we'd better skip that.
When somebody wanted me to join the pioneers, I said, no, I haven't time. you join the Pioneers, then you've got to begin to forget. And I don't want to forget too many things. But if you don't join, don't forget, begin to forget, you can't be a good pioneer. Because about half the people there, he wouldn't speak to you in the old days. So, I'm only an honorary member of the Pioneers. Much of the Pioneers just got.
You never have joined, have you?
I don't believe in the Pioneers. I'll tell you why. They believe that if a woman comes up here and marries someone who is an old-timer, that she becomes a pioneer. She is no more a pioneer than if she had never seen the country before.
Yes, I know what you mean. For instance, I'm a born pioneer.
Sure.
And yet many...
Do you want somebody to come in here and marry somebody and then say they're a pioneer?
I feel that there should be a distinction between the real pioneers and the auxiliary.
I think so, very much so.
Mm-hmm. Also, how do you feel about the racial distinction? I understand that.
I'm fighting this little bit. This little paper. Are you taking that paper? Are you interested in that?
Right here.
Right there. That
is the yellow one.
No, that's our new book of poems. I got a poem in there. I believe these people are capable of being people. And when a girl is one-third, one-fourth white, and three-fourths something else, she has a right to be choose whether she's going to... She shouldn't be put off to say, well, she's native. And I'm fighting this fight now, right now, about... I don't think the name I went on the air. This girl earned the award. Don't put that on.
No, this will be private.
Well, Lorinda Ward is teaching over in the Honolulu University. She's doing some very excellent, outstanding work in trying to get languages. They have languages, a polyglot language. Not just a multi-language, but a polyglot language.
Now, which language are you talking about? One of the Alaska Indians?
No, I'm talking about Honolulu just now and Lorinda over there. And she's working on that. And every time I say anything about how well she's done, she's in charge, I think, of one of the departments of English over there at Honolulu. She used to go to my Sunday school down here, the Episcopal Sunday school. They say, oh, she's done pretty well for a native girl.
Yes.
But Lorinda, family was so nearly white that they freckled. When you call them native,
Yes, it's the same way with other races. If there's a drop of a certain blood, they're called that by that other race.
The Negro is the same
yes. point. Yes, well, this is something that the prejudice that people, I hope, are overcoming.
Are we? That's the whole... But to say that... And then there's this child who's married to one of the professors at the University of Alaska. She told me, her mother had told her, just who she was. She says, I am one quarter white. She made a little circle on the blackboard for me. She says, this is my quarter white. Now, says, over here is my half Eskimo. That's my mother. My mother was half Eskimo. And my father was a Russian scientist that came along and spent the year in the village. And now, good old-fashioned way, in the good old Russian accommodating way, he housed up with this girl, and he very thoughtfully left a picture of a child that was to come before he left when the spring work was through. He'd done his winter's work there as a scientist for the Russian government. And she had the picture of the man that is this girl's father. Ruth knows her grandfather's picture. She knows who her mother was. She had soft reddish hair and this Russian... And the father was a South Carolinian.
The girl that went over to Honolulu?
This is a little girl who's, mm-hmm. who's married to a professor up at the
University. Yes.
At Sandvik. Yes. The Sandviks up here. You can find out a lot about them up around here in Palmer.
Yes.
They used to have
mm-hmm.
a sawmill up there. Yes. Now you see there, Ruth has no... Ruth is always classed, and they'll say, my Ruth has done so well for me. Ruth isn't native.
Yes.
Ruth doesn't think like a native. She, and her mother didn't think like a native. Our mother had taken the training in the hospital there, the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And yet they tried to force them back and tried to make us see that they spoke only the English, their native languages. Well, how could you teach a child the meaning of a word if he didn't know the meaning of the word in some other language?
Wanted to know how transportation entered into the decision on whether or not to buy this land.
Because it took too long for them to get transportation or a letter or anything.
That's what I said. Okay, so they decided they purchased land. How did the president feel about this when they got back? Alan?
She is real too pleased.
April Butts hasn't been on this recorder, has she? Okay, Alan. April. The president wasn't too pleased. What's the first thing the president's going to have to do about this purchase? He's going to have to go to some people and get what? I can't even hear you.
I have to go to the Senate and get it approved.
Get it approved. Okay, did they approve it, April?
Yes.
Okay, so they have got it approved, April, and what's the next thing the president's going to do? What's the first thing you do when you get home after you buy a present? You take it out and do what?
Play with it.
Do what? Explore it or look at it. So the one of the first thing he's going to do when he gets home and finds out he has this land is what, April?
Check it out.
Hold it up. She can get it. I want it on there. Lewis and Clark Expedition. If anyone wants an extra report on any part of the Lewis and Clark Expedition, let me know, because it's real interesting. You run into rapids, they run into wild animals, Indians, there's narrow escape. If you want any, you want to make an extra report on this, let me know and then bring it to class, okay? Lewis and Clark Expedition, it's real interesting to read. You can find a book in the library on it. It's a real interesting book. Has anyone read it? You have, Jerry? Did you like it?
Nope.
Anyone else read it? Carol?
No.
You liked it? How about you, Alan?
I saw the movie.
And most of those incidents are in
the movie is better than the book.
The book. Okay, now. Is there any question about today's discussion? Any questions at all?
Okay, now let's go over here.
Oh, that's too bad. Now, we're talking to Mrs. Florence Hoffman, Mrs. Frank Hoffman, and I'm going to ask her a few questions about Alaska. Mrs. Hoffman, what year did you and your husband come to Alaska?
Well, I came up in the fall of 16.
And was your husband here before that?
He was up here then.
I see. And he came up to do what?
Well, he came up in 98.
One of the real pioneers.
He was a real old pioneer. And he left the territory one time, and that would be about, 1910. And he went out to Idaho, and he tried farming out there for a year or so, but he came back to Alaska then. And he was there, he was back in Alaska ever after that.
Did he come up to prospect for gold?
I imagine that was his idea. He was just a young man then, and it was during the gold rush, and there were so many coming up. And although he never went to Dawson, he came first to Cordova and Valdez, and that's where he spent most of his time.
What did he do in Valdez before he became United States Marshal?
Well, he used to work for the city. He was, in fact, he took care of the both the police and the fireman's job. He was, he had both.
Yes,
he inspected. He'd go around inspect the buildings for as a fire inspector that way and. And then he was city policeman, too. So he's always kind of been in that work.
I see. What year was he appointed United States Marshal?
That was the year that he went in with your father. In 13, that would be,
yes.
I'm sure.
Where did they go that year?
They went into the Susanna.
Was that a mining prospecting area? That
it was a new strike in the new mining venture, and they had been going in there all that summer, and
the prospectors and the miners.
Yes, it had just been discovered that.
And Mr. Hoffman went in as marshal, and Anthony Diamond went in as U.S. commissioner. Is that right?
Yes.
So that when people filed their claims, there'd be some legal
they could take
record
care
of
it.
Yes. I see.
He could take care of it. They had to have the commissioner's office there.
There. Mm-hmm. And so your
so
husband
was the first one.
Your husband was the law and order.
And so they combined. They lived together.
They lived together in a small log cabin.
Sometimes you don't need to record this. I'll tell you.
Yes.
And he was just out of the hospital a short time before he went in there.
Yes. My dad had accidentally shot himself in the leg while he was riding horseback.
He was near
Cordova?
No, that was over in the Nazina country.
Nazina. Now, where is that located?
Well, that's over in the Copper River country, and it's, it's in from McCarthy. You've heard of McCarthy.
Yes.
Well, I don't think they're mining in there now, but they did at that. There was quite a bit of mining going on there at that time. And
he was. I understand he was riding a horse.
Yes.
He told me that he thought he saw a bear. The horse reared as though he saw a bear, and my dad started to pull his gun out of the holster, an automatic pistol, I think.
Yes.
And it accidentally went off.
And he, I guess he was, the horse, when the horse reared up, it went to put it back, and it, I guess it, the trigger caught.
Trigger caught and went off.
And shot him through down his leg, you know.
And he was alone at the time.
He was out alone on the trail, out from the camp. And they got him into the camp, and...
Was this a mining camp or a prospecting camp?
It was a mining camp. Mm-hmm. Frank wasn't there at that time, but of course, he came up the next year, and he knew all about it, and he knew your dad before that. So they had to get him to a doctor. That was the thing. And the only way they could get out was to come out of the pack train, you know, pack
with horses.
With horses. And they had to, then when they'd get to the river, they had to take him down the boat, the Copper River. And they had to build a boat. And you know what a delay that was. It must have been a couple of days before they got started on the trip. And it's a wonder your father ever lived through it, you know.
Loss of blood and everything. Infection.
Infection would set in that time, you know.
Yes.
Naturally.
Before
and,
antibiotics.
So anyway, he was in bad shape. And but they got him to... that's the way I got it, that they first took him to the Kennicott Hospital. That was the nearest. And then I think the doctor went up from Cordova, and they moved him to the Cordova Hospital afterwards. And it was Dr.
Council
that took
Mary
care
Lee
of
Council's
him.
Yes. Father who took mm-hmm. care of him, yeah. Then I understand he was in the hospital for 9 months.
Yes, that's what
in Cordova.
That's what I'd heard.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then it was after he recuperated from this accident that he and Mr. Hoffman went to the Shoshana.
Yes.
And spent the winter there.
Mm-hmm.
If do you recall if it was one of these cold, snowy winters?
Well, Frank always said that he liked the country in there. It was, it was cold. They didn't have much wind or anything. It was just
a dry cold.
Just a dry cold, and he said he rather liked it in there.
That's in the interior of Alaska.
Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, it is in a place like that.
At the time, they don't think these incidents are.
Frank used to tell a story about. He was over here in Anchorage after that, and I can't think now what his name was. But anyway, he was in there, and his wife came up later.
This was another man.
This was another man. And so, of course, Frank is a great kidder, and he thought he'd have some fun with him. And so you're not recording this.
Yes. This is for my benefit.
Well, But anyway, they thought they'd have some fun with him, and he, they made up, Franklin made up something, you know, about, and pretended he didn't know that he was listening, and he was telling her, and about how he had carried on, you know, when she wasn't, all that sort of thing. And so this man spoke up, and he was in another room, and he spoke up, "Say something, Emma." he wanted to let them know that he was there. And he says, "Say something, Emma." Well, Frank was an awful tease. You know, he just wanted it. He wasn't happy if he wasn't teasing somebody.
Yeah. Well, then they came out the following summer after being in the Shoshana for
one
winter.
Well, they didn't come. Your dad came out ahead at first, mm-hmm. and then I can't remember when Frank said he came out, but Frank was in there 2 winters. Then he came out the next spring, and Anchorage had started then.
And that was Anchorage started about
1915. And they had the. There might have been some people here in 14. I don't know. The engineers laying out.
They started it as a railroad city,
yes.
Didn't they? Were there a few white settlers here even before that time? Or wasn't there any reason for them to be here?
You know, there was the Bud Whitneys were here. They were. I had a ranch out here somewhere. They call it Whitney Station.
What
now.
Did they raise on the ranch?
Oh, he had gardens and truck and pigs and chickens.
Oh, he raised almost a little farm. Mm-hmm.
And then after Anchorage started, people would go out there. They had a kind of it was a place that served meals and that sort of thing, you know.
Almost a roadhouse.
Yeah, sort of a place to get out of town. And Mrs. Whitney was a very good cook, and there were just the two of them. Well, then Lily Brown, you know her.
Well, yeah, yes.
They came over before the town was started, and they took up a homestead right down here on the Ship Creek or someplace.
Yes. Now, did she sell that land many, many years ago to...
He's still living, too, Mr. Brown.
Oh, Mr. Brown.
Oh, yes, too. Jack Brown.
Yes.
And they sold it when they... after the... the army came up here, you know, and took over that ground about there.
Oh, I see.
They sold it to them then.
Now it would be
and
worth
Whitney
a great deal.
And Whitney sold theirs, too.
Yeah.
And they went outside then.
I see. Now, you came up here as a single girl then?
I came up the fall of 16.
And you were single?
Yeah.
What did you come up to do? To go to work?
No, I came up to live here.
With some of your family?
And no.
Mm-hmm.
No, I just thought, well, I wanted to come to Alaska.
Wanted to see the world, because in those days, girls didn't travel the way as they do nowadays.
And then Frank was up here, so...
Met him. What year were you married?
We were married then when I came up.
Oh, you had known him before?
Oh, yes.
Oh,
yes.
I see. You were engaged.
And, of course, I never went into the Shoshana. I knew him.
I see. You had already met him.
Yes.
I thought perhaps you came up here and then met him.
Mm-hmm. And...
So you were married in 1916.
That's fall of 16.
It's the same year that my mother and father were married.
Yes, that you see, your dad had come back from Shoshana too, and
they were married in Valdez.
What year? What month were they married?
February.
In February.
Of 16.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
then you've seen Anchorage almost since the beginning.
Since the summer before I got here in November. And the summer before, they had what they called the tent town down here in Ship Creek.
Yes.
Well, then when I got here, there was quite a few places over on where the main part of Anchorage here now. The Anchorage Hotel was there, and the what's the Lane Hotel now was it had another name then, and we stayed there.
Oh. I suppose the streets were dirt and the sidewalks were wooden sidewalks.
Oh yes, and mm-hmm. not too many of them, you know.
Yeah.
At that time, of course, the next year, then everything built up.
How did the supplies get into Anchorage before the railroad was built from Seward?
Well, the boats came in here.
They came in,
yes.
But they had to do as they do today and watch the tides.
They'd come in as close as they could, and then they'd lighter in
the freight.
The passengers and the freight.
And small boats.
They call them lighters, I think.
Yes, mm-hmm. I see. So you've seen Anchorage grow from just mm-hmm. a tent town to the city.
And then they were building the railroad, of course, from Seward, and they'd come as far as they could on the railroad, then they'd come by dog team the rest of the way if they were coming over the trail, you see.
Yes.
But from Seward. But the boats came in. Of course, the boats couldn't come in after November.
After November.
There was one boat after the one that I got in on.
Mm-hmm.
It was a smaller boat.
What month did you arrive?
In November.
In November.
The 7th of November.
I see. What state did you come up from?
Seattle.
Oh, you're from Seattle.
I'd been in Seattle for quite a while.
I see. Mm-hmm. But even today, people think Alaska's far away, and I mm-hmm. suppose back in 1916 they thought you were going
well,
going
those
quite
days
a distance.
It didn't seem so much further, of course, because there wasn't any planes.
And it took how many days on the boat?
It took about 10 days on
10
the
days
boat.
For you to come up.
Mm-hmm.
And the boat came?
Oh, sometimes it'd make a little better time, but you could count about 10 days.
I see. How were prices then, as far as food and clothing was concerned? Were things terribly expensive?
No, I don't think they were any more so than they
are now.
Not much any different, you know. A little more than Seattle, but not so much. I'm not used to that thing. I just feel like talking to him. Of course, he'd come over whenever court was here. And this Valdez was the headquarters then, and they'd come over here a couple times a year for court. And your father was always law, and it was would have a case stick before the court. And
yes, and now he, I can't remember what year he passed the bar, but it must have been about 1914 or so, wasn't it?
Yes, because he took up a little while he was in the hospital. He studied while he was when he was so.
And then he studied in Mr. Donahoe's office.
Yes, they were.
They were partners.
Partners
for many years.
Yes.
Diamond and Donahoe.
Yes.
So you saw my dad frequently.
Oh yes, whenever he'd come over Anchorage, he'd always be come wherever we were, because he and Frank were like brothers.
They were so close.
They were certainly were.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I must show you the. I thought I had an extra copy of that too, but I don't know. I'll show it to you. It's in the scrapbook of what your dad said about Franklin. And you know, I got a wire from him the day after Frank's death, and I wondered how he got the word so quick.
Yes, were you back in Washington?
They were
in those
back
days?
In Washington. He was in Washington. That was in 37.
37.
And he came up then. Right after that, he and James Farley,
they
made a trip
general.
Up here.
Yes, and you saw him
or,
then.
Maybe your dad was up here, but anyway, that he met him and they came over here together,
mm-hmm.
and so he came out to see me, and I didn't happen to be home, but he left. I had been out to the they had a dinner. Lunch for them out at the Idle Hour, and I was out there and I got to see him, but he didn't know, he was so busy he didn't know when he'd get out to the,
mm-hmm.
the house, so he came, and I hadn't happened to get back yet when he was there, and
mm-hmm.
so he left a note, and I did see him afterwards, and I asked him how he got the word and so fast, and because, you know, it wasn't in the paper or anything. And he said that Harry Morton, you know, he was an attorney up here.
Mm-hmm.
But he wasn't here. He was in California. But he heard it over the somewhere. And he wired
dad
to Washington.
Oh.
And so that's how he got the news so quick.
I see. Uh-huh.
I think he knew he was sick, but he didn't think that it was serious.
Yeah.
I always thought it was too bad. You're not recording now.
Yes, but this is just the impressions of my father.
I'll tell you after what I
all right.
Yeah.